This is Jim Inkster. Coming today, we will visit with Ambassador Francis Rooney. The book is The Global Vatican, an inside look at the Catholic Church, world politics, and the extraordinary relationship between the United States and the Holy See. Also, Richard Gibbons, an ornithologist who spent a lot of years here in Baton Rouge, now is in Houston doing his thing and has written a book about birding in Louisiana. And we'll hear from Carolyn Bennett, the Foundation for Historical Louisiana, celebrating its 50th year of existence, an organization that has substantial prominence in this community. And, of course, Carolyn's been in the news of late. We will talk with her about everything going on with the foundation. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your local number. Outside the area, it's 877-217-5757, and you may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. Our leadoff guest is Ambassador Francis Rooney. He was the U.S. Ambassador to the Holy See from 2005 to 2008. He's the CEO of Rooney Holdings, and he's here to discuss the Catholic Church and his book, The Global Vatican, an inside look at the Catholic Church, world politics, and the extraordinary relationship between the United States and the Holy See. Good morning.
Thank you, Jim. Good morning to you.
Good to talk with you, Ambassador Rooney. Well, tell us about this relationship between the U.S. and the Vatican.
Well, I mean, this is why I wrote the book, that many people realize, you know, what the church, Catholic Church, does as a church, but they don't realize the important contributions that the Holy See, the head of the organization and influence of the church, has accomplished in the world of international affairs with its diplomatic outreach. And they've been recognized as a sovereign entity since the 8th century, and as such can project a unique form of influence in the world, and have many times centered basically around the fundamental principles that guide the church teachings, you know, the promotion of human dignity, the protection of individual rights and liberties, and religious freedom. And given the fact that they have no territory to speak of, 109 acres, you know, and that they have no hegemonic agenda, they have a unique platform to be taken seriously and to express these fundamental principles, which are important for good government and good civic life.
There are those who would say the Catholic Church at times has been a negative force in world affairs. There have been certainly violent acts committed in the name of God. Does the Vatican share any complicity with this?
Well, you know, I think it's important, especially in the context of the discussion of radical Islam of today and the occasional parallels to the 12th and 13th centuries, that we evaluate conduct in the context of its time. And we would not expect behavior like took place in the Middle Ages by the church or anyone else today, just as we don't expect the violence and mayhem in the name of religion that is perpetrated through the radical elements of Islam. In fact, the evolution of the civilization of man from those Middle Age and barbaric times to where we are now is, I think, a testament to a diplomacy centered around on nurturing human dignity and protecting the individual and seeking to spread freedom.
The Vatican has been referred to, in fact, one of the people who reviewed your book called it a superpower. Is it a superpower from a political standpoint?
No, it's a superpower because of its righteous, principle-driven diplomacy, I would say. The influence and power of the Holy See can stem only from the rectitude of its principles and its ability to articulate and express the need for those fundamental principles in conduct around the world and in the conduct of governments and in the conduct of civil societies.
You must have known Lindy Boggs.
Oh, for sure. She was a wonderful person. and she was a very much beloved ambassador at the Holy See.
Well, in Louisiana, we have a substantial Catholic population, and I think people in our state probably don't appreciate the prejudice against Roman Catholics in other parts of this country, much less the rest of the world. Is that still a factor in this country and beyond today?
I don't think it's a factor as much in the United States, as obviously, as it was in the 60s and certainly back in the 19th century that I've tried to write about in the book. But, you know, there's always outbreaks of prejudice and persecution against any minority or even sometimes against majority sects. You know, I think the major persecution of Catholics and Christians right now is taking place in the Middle East and in some extent in North Africa, certainly Egypt, where the radical Islamicists have sought to purge any religion that's not consistent with their own radical sect of Islam, mostly Shiite or Salafist.
What do you make of the current Pope, who was named after you?
Well, I don't think he's named after me, but he's named after St. Francis of Assisi, who was certainly one of the greatest saints of all time. And I'm excited about the new Pope. I'm excited to have a Pope from the New World. You know, he's not Eurocentric like every preceding Pope. He's not bound up in the cultural attributes of Europe, and he's got a real great candor and openness to him that I think is refreshing, and willingness to look at things in new ways, like some of the outreaches that he's undertaken with review of the Vatican Bank, looking at the Curia reform, trying to bring more of an executive-style organization to the last vestiges of a monarchical organization. I think that's real healthy. And, of course, the fact that he spent 12 years fighting the authoritarian socialist Kirchner regime, and before that, back in the early 80s, fought hard against the dictatorship of Videla in Argentina, shows that the guy has got his stripes, that he's faced tough things, and he can do the right thing. And I'm really encouraged for what he might be able to accomplish for the world, and especially Latin America.
297-5633 is your number. We'll take a call or two as we move along in our remaining time with Ambassador Francis Rooney. He was ambassador to the Holy See from 2005 to 2008. The book is The Global Vatican. How does one get appointed as ambassador to the Vatican?
Well, I think you have to know the President of the United States pretty well. The European ambassadorships, and particularly the Holy See, are considered considered positions that are very close to the President. The Holy See mission really depends upon the interest and alignment of principles between the administration and the Holy See. And so to be appointed by the President, for me, was a fantastic honor and opportunity and a great challenge to make sure I would live up to what he expected.
The President was George Bush for you. Did you lobby for the position?
No, I never. I was shocked when the White House personnel office called and wanted to speak with me about it.
Shocked, but I'm sure honored.
Oh, super excited for sure, but I never would have expected that.
Bruce and Walden. Bruce, please be brief. You're on with Ambassador Francis Rooney.
Yeah, I too am a little bit hopeful about Francis, but Benedict for me was a nightmare. He was the hatchet man for liberation theology for about 15 years, hardly an endorsement for support for religious freedom in Latin America, and an open alliance with the worst elements in Latin America.
Do you think this is an improvement to Pope Francis over Pope Benedict?
If I could answer, you know, I think that I wrote that in the book, that it's unfortunate that many times in Latin America the church has found itself too much aligned with one side or the other to their detriment in terms of expressing a more broadly based humanitarian message. You know, John Paul, the beloved John Paul, who did so many wonderful things, was the originator of the usually anti-liberation theology movement because he filtered everything through communism, through his experience fighting communists his whole life. And he saw parts of liberation theology as being too close to that for him. Benedict, as you say correctly, followed the same line and took a hard line, and I think that it's probably good to divorce behavior from dogma a little bit. Latin America needs a strong middle class, and some of the arguments that are made about too few having too many are indisputable arguments, right?
877-217-5757. A bit more time with Ambassador Rooney. Francis Rooney's book is The Global Vatican. Charles on North Foster, good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen. My question is, Jesus said, call no religious leader father. So how does the Catholic Church refer to the Pope as the Holy Father? And can you tell me about the difference between the Catholic Ten Commandments and the Mosaic Ten Commandments?
All right.
Well, I think Holy Father is considered kind of a term of endearment rather than a term of hierarchical subjugation or anything. Father is a paternal comment. I don't know really. When you get off into too much theology, that's not my strongest point. I'm a whole lot more focused on diplomacy and how to have the Holy See's principles work for the betterment of international relations. But I don't know that there's a lot of difference between the two Ten Commandments. I could be off base here, but I went to St. Catherine's Monastery one time where the burning bush is and where Moses was, and now it's operated by Greek Orthodox priests, so it's kind of an ecumenical site.
Ambassador Rooney is a graduate of Georgetown's Law Center, good Catholic university, and also the alma mater for President Clinton. I'm sure that's an irony that President Clinton is the only U.S. president to graduate from a Catholic university.
Well, and there were some rubs with the Clinton administration and the Holy See, certainly back under the Cairo Population Conference in 1995, which was dealt with by Ray Flynn, who was Lindy's predecessor at the Holy See. But Clinton was also, he saw the Pope a few times, and they had a fairly active engagement in other areas that were removed from the life issues.
Mm-hmm. Do you think the Church will take any stands contrary to longstanding ones on issues like abortion and female priests?
No, I don't. But I think what the Pope was saying is kind of like my mother used to have an expression in the South, let's stop beating a dead horse. He's saying we're not going to change our dogma, but there's also a lot of other things the Church needs to be talking about, social justice, protecting human dignity, helping people improve their lot in life, etc. So we can't just dominate the discussion by a few issues. I thought that was pretty good thing, the way the Pope did that.
Ambassador Rooney, how much of a distraction and a scandal has the sexual revelations involving priests, particularly in the United States, how much has that taken a toll on the Church?
Well, I think there's no doubt that it's taken a toll in the United States. We've all seen and heard so many things, and in other parts of the developed world to a lesser extent. Now, in the realm of the Church's diplomatic work, a lot of the areas where there's the greatest opportunity for the principles of Holy See diplomacy to work constructively with countries like the United States are not in countries where there are abuse scandals, or if there are, I don't know about them. For example, the areas where freedom and human dignity are most restricted and under attack are areas in Africa, Eastern Europe, some of the authoritarian countries of Latin America, where the abuse scandals really haven't had a lot of play.
Well, the Church has been able to withstand a couple of thousand years of ups and downs, and based on your perception, you think the Church has relevance today and beyond.
I do, and it's kind of like that famous Stalin quote where he said, how many divisions does the Pope have? And every time I give a speech, I mention that, and I say, the Pope is still here, but Stalin's long gone, and so is the oppressive system that he tried to deploy. And one of the lines I think we put in the book is that the Church has been historically persecuted and managed to survive over years, and these fundamental principles are so enduring that I think in many ways we need these principles articulated diplomatically by an entity like the Holy See more than ever.
Well, thank you, Ambassador Francis Rooney. The book is The Global Vatican. Pleasure to talk with you, sir.
Thank you very much, Jim.
This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, and our guest is Richard Gibbons. He's the Director of Conservation for Houston Audubon. He's worked as an ornithologist, and he is a man who's familiar with Louisiana and Baton Rouge. For the last 17 years, he's been doing his things with birds and also familiar with his activities throughout the world. And good morning to you, Richard Gibbons.
Well, good morning to you, and thanks for having me on the show.
Well, before we get to Louisiana, and his book is The Birder's Guide to Louisiana, you've spent time in places like Peru, for example.
That's right. Quite a bit different, but we do share a few birds.
Which few?
Oh, the shorebirds in particular were my interest. The things like pectoral sandpiper, things you might find out in the rice fields in the springtime, in April particularly. You wouldn't really notice them unless you went looking for them, but it's always nice to make the connections between these far-flung habitats across the globe.
Well, you have collaborated with a couple of other bird authorities for a 275-page book, A Birder's Guide to Louisiana. It gives readers just about all they need to find Louisiana's resident and migratory birds. Is this a good place for bird watching?
It is an exceptional place for bird watching or birding, and we probably don't need to get into cleaving those two definitions, but for bird enthusiasts, this book is designed to make it much easier, and we've worked with the American Birding Association, which is the group that really promotes bird watching per se, and this is it is the first bird finding guide from the American Birding Association for Louisiana, and the first one that was done by so many Louisiana birders. Everybody pitched in, so we're proud of the product.
What are some of the best spots in Louisiana?
It depends on what you're looking for, and some people really want to see very specific birds. They may want to go and see a red-cockaded woodpecker up in the piney woods, and to do that, there's the Nature Conservancy. They have a preserve, but the coast is always the place to go, especially if you want to see migratory birds, and that's what makes Louisiana special, is that it's at the crossroads for so many migratory birds.
Rice fields are very good as well, aren't they?
Really, really good. And a new thing that has happened that is truly unique to Louisiana, and I believe it's going on right now, is the Yellow Rails and Rice Festival. And I know that doesn't seem like a natural fit, those two things. And who knows what a yellow rail is? Most people don't. And it's one of the most elusive, sought-after birds to see. And most people, of course, never, ever get a chance to see it. And even the most avid of bird watchers, there's this last few birds that are on their list if they want to see them all. And yellow rail is always one that's on that list. And so some bird watchers, they got together with some rice growers, and they figured out that these yellow rails were stopping off and overwintering in these rice fields. And so when they would go and do the second cut in November, they would see these birds flying out of there. And the bird watchers used to just camp out on the highway, a risky business, and set their spotting scopes up in front of the combines, and they would see the flash of the white and the wing of the yellow rail coming out from in front of the combine, and that would be the best look they could get until someone made a conversation with a rice grower, and they said, well, come on aboard. And from there, you know, now with a new law that allows agritourism to happen, we get tourists from all over the country come to ride on the rice combines and see four or five different species of rails and finally get to see their yellow rail. So, yeah, rice fields, fantastic place.
The guest is Richard Gibbons. Dr. Gibbons is the co-author of A Birder's Guide to Louisiana. Van Remsen, a professor at LSU, says probably no state in the United States can compete with Louisiana in terms of bird spectacles. Bird density in general is higher here than almost anywhere in the country, and some of the concentrations are stunning. And this has been noted for generations. Certainly Audubon's influence in Louisiana is a prominent one.
Absolutely. A lot of states will, especially Kentucky and some of the other states will fly their Audubon flag, but as Danny Hyman wrote in his book chronicling the time that John James Audubon spent up in the Florida parishes, he spent a lot of time here, and it was a place that he really enjoyed and got to learn a lot about the bird life of North America here in Louisiana.
Well, your co-authors, you're an ornithologist, but these are interesting folks who have this passion. Roger Breedlove, he's a prosecuting attorney in Rapides Parish. Charles Lyon is a physician in North Louisiana. How did they get involved with you, Richard?
That's a good story. This book was well underway and had actually kind of gotten to the 50-yard line to completion when I moved to Louisiana from Texas to start my PhD program at the Museum of Natural Science. And part of the position, so my position was at the Louisiana Bird Resource Office, and it was to focus more on Louisiana bird projects. And getting this bird finding guide was one, and they're busy guys and had the chops to know all the information. And they'd reached a point where we got to get somebody to finish this thing. And so they handed it off to me as part of my assistantship at LSU. And so I took it from there and fleshed out a few more sites, got some of the artwork done, photography, updated it after Katrina and Rita, and you know, things change. So it's this constantly moving target. So with the help of way too many people to name, it really was a product of the entire Louisiana birding community. We finally made it across the field goal with tremendous help from not only the Atchafalaya Natural Heritage Area, which provided some funding, but also the American Birding Association, which provided some book craft.
It's A Birder's Guide to Louisiana from Richard Gibbons and Roger Breedlove and Charles Lyon. Now, Richard, you were at LSU for how long?
Oh, man, a PhD program, I should probably not say how many years I was there. 6 years I was there at LSU, and I'll say that was average.
Well, and you're director of conservation for Houston Audubon, and your better half is a great reporter who many of our listeners will remember well, Kimberly Vetter.
Yes, and she's also a birder. I suspect most people didn't know that about her.
Well, when she wasn't covering crime, she was watching birds.
That's right. Whether she liked it or not, she often got called an SOB, which was a spouse of a birder. and she was okay with that. And I keep her list. I know it a lot better than she does. So she falls maybe more into the bird watcher category than a true birder.
Well, A Birder's Guide to Louisiana. It's the book from Richard Gibbons along with Roger Breedlove and Charles Lyon. And we thank you for your time today, and good luck. Let's talk again.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Gibbons. And we're joined in studio by Carolyn Bennett. For 38 years, she's been head of the Foundation for Historical Louisiana, and that organization is about to celebrate its 50th anniversary. Good morning, Carolyn.
Good morning, Jim.
And you're not originally from these parts.
No, but I've been here a long time. Came here in 1974 and grew up in an Army family, so I've traveled quite a bit.
Well, and Carolyn has been a big part of this community, has a great birthday, January 15th, which she shares with Ernest Gaines. And we're glad you're in the hot seat. And you've been in the news a lot of late. We'll get to some of that, but I'm counting one, two, three front page stories. And then one in the Sunday Eat, Play, and Live section in The Advocate. Golden Year, making plans for a Foundation for Historical Louisiana celebration. What's going to happen to note year number 50 for your fine group?
Well, let me start off by saying January 15th is a great birthday. It's also Martin Luther King's birthday.
That's right.
And Jim Angster's birthday, I do believe.
Well, in the hierarchy, I'd have to place Ernest and Gaines and Martin Luther King right up there, like tied for first. You'd be next, and then maybe I'm somewhere down the line. But we're a little ways away from that day, but we're not far away from November the 13th, which is next week. And you'll celebrate your 50-year anniversary.
And it will be a celebration. We've chosen a Wednesday night because that's the actual incorporation day of our organization in 1963. And there were 10 incorporators on the legal document, and one of them will be with us, Miss Sue Spate of Baton Rouge. And she is 94 years old now, and just you can look at her today and realize what a mover and shaker she was in the early days of the organization.
Well, the celebration is next week, the 13th. That's Wednesday. And if you'd like to participate at the Old Governor's Mansion, 7:30 to 11 p.m., you may call the foundation at 225-387-2464. That's 225-387-2464. And I'm sure, like celebrations of this kind, in a majestic structure where you're located, you're going to have a lot of movers and shakers.
Well, we will, and I also want to remind your listeners that the preservation movement has a lot of young people in it now, and there is a specially priced ticket of $50 for those who'd like to attend under 35 years of age.
Suddenly that night there might be a lot of people under 35.
We won't ask any questions.
Okay, well, we'll talk about the celebration as we move along with Carolyn, who's been gracious enough to come here and talk with us. And I'm looking at Saturday's Baton Rouge Advocate, front page, Metro. It says, head of historic commission, ineligible. What's going on with the alleged term limits involving you?
Well, the Historic Preservation Commission dates back to 2004, and I was appointed then. I was reappointed in 2007. At that time, I was the designee from the Foundation for Historical Louisiana. In 2011, the ordinance for the Historic Preservation Commission was rewritten, and there were no, if you will, designated hitters from the DDD or FHL, and I was appointed for a third term, just as Carolyn Bennett, citizen, if you will. But that was evidently an error on the part of the city parish and the Metro Council, and I have already served the maximum term of 8 years. However, the governing parish attorney's office rules that until a successor is named, I continue to do my public service, and at this time as chair of the Historic Preservation Commission. So it may take several months to do this. They do advertise the opening on a board and commission for roughly 60 days, and the soonest I might be replaced would be January 8th, but we'll see.
Which would be 1 week before your birthday. But so does that mean after 38 or 39 years that this will be it for you?
At the Foundation for Historical Louisiana?
Yes.
No, those are two separate entities. The Historic Preservation Commission is under the city parish, and that is what allows us to be a certified local government. The foundation is a private entity that I've been lucky to spend my professional career with.
So let me get it straight. That means that you're role as head of the commission would be over, but you would continue until otherwise notified as a person who runs the show at the foundation, which is celebrating its 50th anniversary, correct?
And when you say running the show, you have to remember I have a remarkable board of directors, 19 people. Doug Cochran is the current chairman. There's a great professional staff in place that has grown over the years. We have docents. We have volunteers. It's a team effort. Mm-hmm. And most of all, we have a membership. We're membership-based. We need the dues. We need the donations. We get no public funds.
Are any members of your board at the foundation also members of the Historic Preservation Commission?
No, not at this time.
So it's really two separate entities.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Other than having you as a common denominator.
Correct, correct. And actually, that's very logical. It's a Historic Preservation Commission. You want persons who are qualified to make decisions about architecture, about cultural heritage. So there is a description of who makes a good commission member.
And how many commission members are there?
At this time, the ordinance calls for 7 commission members. I'd like to see it enlarged as it once was before.
Okay, 7, and you're one of the 7.
Correct.
Here's the story front page, October 25th, not so long ago, as in just 11 days ago. Metro Councilman Ryan Heck called for the resignations of 3 members of the Historic Preservation Commission, whom he called clowns in an email exchange. Heck in the email accused the commissioners of using their office to provide favors to friends and of violating the state's open meeting laws. That story from Rebecca Allen. Were there any laws that were violated?
Well, I have learned that the open meetings and public meetings requirements deal with number of persons, not intent. And indeed, our commission met on 2 occasions informally, one to look at a landmark property and one to welcome a new member. And we did not post that this would be a gathering. The parish attorney's office states that no matter what you're doing, if you have a majority of your commission members present, that's considered a public meeting. Now, there are other attorneys who have been calling me and stating they do not believe that is the case, but that is the position the parish attorney's office has taken. So certainly everything related to those meetings was transparent. The planning commission knew. But the rules weren't followed for posting it and placing the notice on a website. So I take responsibility for that, and we certainly will continue knowing now fully the rules.
Well, in an email, as the advocate reported, sent at 12:22 in the morning, the councilman, Mr. Heck, called on you and Mr. Huey and Mr. Sykes to resign from the commission. Is there any move to do that, or have you discarded the councilman's objections?
Well, again, I do not understand Councilman Heck's motive. He's never met we 3 clowns, in his words. And he's never requested a meeting. Why these ad hominem attacks?
297-5633 if you'd like to join the conversation. Carolyn Bennett preparing for a major anniversary of the Foundation for Historical Louisiana at the same time that the commission, the Historical Preservation Commission, is under fire, in particular from Metro Councilman Ryan Heck, who might show up at the 50th anniversary party next week. We'll talk more with Carolyn after this 90-second pause on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Inkster's show at WRKF.org works if you'd like to reach us by email, or you may call 297-5633. Or 877-217-5757. As mentioned, Carolyn Bennett, who's been around for, what, that'd be 76% of the 50 years that the foundation has been in existence, is preparing for next Wednesday's, that's 8 nights away, affair at the Old Governor's Mansion, 502 North Boulevard, the 50th anniversary of the Foundation for Historical Louisiana, at the same time that the Preservation Commission, of which she is a part, one of 7 members, is under fire, and has been, 3 members of the commission have been called clowns by Councilman Ryan Heck, who has been sending emails in the middle of the night. He's obviously quite passionate about this. Here's a question or a comment from Swede White. Correct me if I'm wrong, but doesn't the Preservation Commission grant residential certificates of appropriateness to Dreher Place in the Garden District in Spanish Town only? Why can't these two small neighborhoods handle their own issues in their own neighborhoods? Why is a city parish bureaucracy necessary for this? That from Mr. Swede White. You want to respond, Carol?
Well, the certificates of appropriateness, yes, are required in two historic districts, neighborhoods, Dreer Place and Spanish Town. And the neighbors themselves ask to come under the Historic Preservation Commission. They, years ago, went through neighborhood discussions and determined their guidelines. And we are the governmental body that enforces them. And it is a protection for them, and it has been proved that when guidelines that are written and followed for historic neighborhoods, that those property values hold strong and continue to rise. So again, it's the neighborhoods themselves that have requested this.
Okay, 2975633. I have another question from Steve in Mid-City regarding your issues with Ralph McCollister. And I did pull up a story 6 days ago in the Business Report, by the way, which is owned by Mr. McCollister. It says, Carolyn Bennett, preservation leader and executive director of the Foundation for Historical Louisiana, strongly denies accusations of Business Report editor Ralph McCollister in his recently published article, which states that she acted with favoritism and under the cover of darkness in the application process of the Historic City Park Golf Course application for designation on the National Register of Historic Places.
Well, Mr. McCollister's facts are wrong. You cannot get a landmark on the National Register of Historic Places without a lengthy process, without a transparent discussion. And the Foundation for Historical Louisiana did not make the application. It came from the Division of Historic Preservation. And Rolf is simply wrong. He has long had other ideas for that beautiful cultural landscape, and he continues to bait preservationists about the procedure of putting it on the National Register. And the fact of the matter is, the National Register does not prevent demolition or defilement. The only protection is if there's federal monies and then there is a Section 106 hearing. But the worst that could happen is it's taken off the National Register. But I do believe he was perhaps dismayed that his poll on the Historic Preservation Commission in the online report came back very much in favor, a Louisiana landslide to keep the HPC, and the BREC survey came back that City Park should remain historically a nine-hole golf course, which is a small part of that park, along with all the other amenities.
2975633 for Carolyn Bennett, answering all inquiries. Terry downtown asks if the Huey Long Pool is on the National Register of Historic Places.
The Huey P. Long Pool is indeed on the National Register of Historic Places, and it's been on the Foundation for Historical Louisiana's Treasures and Troubles list. And I would love to give an update on that terrific landmark on the LSU campus. The foundation has been in discussions with Dean Damon Andrew and his staff. He is head of the LSU College of Human Sciences and Education. And under Dean Laura Lindsay, there is a plan for this building and the pool itself. Tipton and Associates has done, has created a program where the buildings, the lovely brick structure surrounding the pool, mm-hmm. will be preserved according to the Secretary of the Interior standards. The pool, which is actually an above-ground pool, will be not returned as a pool. The demands for classroom space and office space in that particular building, where the boilers were, where the lockers were, this will give that college a fine, fine home. But the pool will be, at this time, filled in a green space with a water feature. And we're talking about commemorative plaques, but it may even change more. But that building, which certainly needs help and has been in deferred maintenance, will come back as a gathering space for students.
Stephen in Central Highlands. Stephen, you're on with Carolyn Bennett.
Two questions. One is, is the Foundation for Historical Louisiana still running the shop at the top of the state capitol? And if so, and I don't know if that's so, but if so, when will they return that shop to the blind vendor who rightly should have that shop?
The Foundation for Historical Louisiana does run the shop at the top of the capitol in a cooperative endeavor agreement with the Joint Legislative Budgetary Committee. We were invited to be there and have been there as ambassadors for the building. There was a blind vendor there in the past. There is a concession stand for a blind vendor in the basement area, I believe. We were sued along with the state over that spot, and we had a positive decision in the favor of this cooperative endeavor agreement.
297-5633. Thank you, Stephen. Jeff asks about the Lincoln Theater. I walk by the Lincoln on a regular basis. It still looks in disrepair. Is there any movement toward making that historic landmark
there,
what it should be?
It's a great mid-century modern landmark and so important to the African-American heritage of Baton Rouge. And it's going to be an anchor of all that's exciting that is going to take place in, I don't call it Old South Baton Rouge, I call it Bold South Baton Rouge. You may not notice it, Jim, but there has been extensive clean out of the theater itself, and through a Brownsfield grant, there is going to be abatement taking place, mm-hmm. phase one, and there is a dynamic group of persons on a board called the Louisiana Black History and Hall of Fame, headed up by founder-director Brenda Perry, and the Lincoln Theater will happen, and it is a project that requires many volunteers. LSU students were there several weeks ago doing some down and dirty work, but it is underway, and we hope to showcase each phase as it goes along.
Have you seen that art display across the street, the outdoor art, the murals? They're amazing, from the Lincoln right now.
Yes, yes. That is a private individual, Dr. Kevin Harris, who has created that museum of public art. It's just wonderful to see, and there are now murals on the west side of the Lincoln Theater as well.
Well, the mural of Richard Pryor is just amazing. So I would suggest anybody who wishes to walk down Olive Street, I think that's a street that crosses through, Myrtle, it's Myrtle Street.
It's Myrtle.
Then you can see some spectacular art across the street from the Lincoln Theater. Why do so many people in other parts of the city refrain from going to that part of town? I walk through there two or three times a week. I haven't had any issues at all. Why do people just refrain from visiting that part of town?
Well, there are many abandoned buildings there. And if people don't live in that area, as opposed to the lakes offering an amenity and where people walk.
We need variety, though. I walk the lakes, too.
Well, hold on, Jim. Just wait a few years. People will be coming to Old South Baton Rouge.
I hope so. We had the tragic death a few weeks ago of a young man who worked at LSU and at Southern and at McKinley, shot to death right at McKinley or at Washington and Braddock Streets. Those are the kinds of things I think that dissuade people from coming. They're rare, but they do happen. We do live in a city with some violence, no doubt about it. And some people would say you're taking chances by doing that, but nobody's immune from this. And for the most part, it's probably in the thousands now, the number of times that that I've walked that area, and I've never had one problem.
Well, what's often forgotten is preservation and the return of buildings to commerce really is a game changer for cities and towns. And preservation as an economic development tool has made such a difference in our cities and bringing back those who walk and people. Just look at our downtown now and the vibrancy that is present.
You're right. And it wasn't long ago that downtown was a veritable wasteland, but that has changed. John Williams writes, does Carolyn know what became of the large statue near the Pentagon of someone on a horse during Mike Foster's administration? It was removed and to be relocated in the city. What was the statue and where did it go? Do you know?
Of a man on a horse, I do not know.
I
know there was a Claire Chennault statue at one time, but I'm sorry. We need to... John, send me any more information you have.
What's your email, Carolyn, for those who'd like to contact you after the show?
It's Carolyn Bennett, CarolynBennett, at FHL.org.
Here's a question from a listener, Michelle, about the old Turkish Baths place in Old South Baton Rouge, torn down, about 5 years ago, supposedly for renovation and restoration of something new, and yet if you walk by there, it's just a patch of grass. What's going on with that? That place had great historical significance.
It did. And that is the worst kind of demolition, speculative demolition, when something is taken down because there's a wish or a promise of something else coming, but there's no concrete plan and there's no financing in place. So you've lost your historic building and you have a big hole that remains.
That place was the old Alvin Roy studio where Bob Pettit built himself into a pro basketball Hall of Famer and Billy Cannon built himself into a Heisman Trophy winner. And before that, I'm told it was the first radio station in Baton Rouge where WJBO was located. How can you just tear a building like that down? I remember driving by one Sunday and it's going down and it got down in a hurry. Did you have any advance warning on this?
No, we did not have any advance warning on this. And there was the old WJBO sign that was there that I remember seeing. How much easier would it have been for someone to just mothball the building, stabilize it, and wait and see what might be done? And once a building goes down, you have no access to historic preservation tax credits that can add up to 45% of your restoration costs.
Well, the Golden Year Golden Party Gala, November 13th, next week at the Old Governor's Mansion, will take place with Carolyn Bennett at the door, welcoming all comers, even Councilman Heck if he decides to show. And the number to call for more information is 225-387-2464, 225-387-2464. Thank you, Carolyn.
Thank you, Jim. Thank
Happy
you for the callers.
50th anniversary. And we'll be back tomorrow for Kevin Gallagher. I'm Jim Engster. Thank you so much for listening, and stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.